Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and today we welcome Bruce Allison to the microphone. Bruce, professional arborist, and has been a regular on our program for a long, long time, and he comes by every so often to talk with you and with me about trees and shrubs, and he's got lots of great advice every single time. You can join in if you have a question about your trees or trees in general. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Give us a call, send us an email, we'll be glad to respond. Bruce, welcome back. Nice to have you with us.
Well, Larry, always wonderful to be with you.
Hate to start on a negative note, but we have the emerald ash borer now located in Wisconsin. Any advice for people with ash trees or just in general?
Well, and boy, what a challenge this is.
Yeah.
And as you know, it came in the Detroit area now, almost a decade ago. I still remember flying into the Detroit airport from Madison and looking down in the middle of the summer and seeing nothing but brown leaves down there.
Mm.
Just a remarkable loss. I mean, millions and millions of trees lost there. We have a huge advantage over them in that we have invested in the science and the research to figure out what is the nature of this insect. They had even no idea early on that it was an insect that was killing all these trees. It took a while to kind of figure that out, to identify where it came from, to understand how it progressed from tree to tree. We now have the opportunity for much better protocols to be in place early on. Other states, I think a total of 10 other states, also have emerald ash borer infestations. Certainly, in a meta sense, in a broader sense, a better understanding of one of the other aspects of globalization, that it's so easy not just for people to move around the planet, but for other species to also move. People are so frightened that they want to cut down their tree right now, and I certainly don't recommend that. Because we have this advantage of better understanding the progress of the insect, we know full well that it only flies about a mile or so a year. The real vector of this insect are these two-legged creatures walking on the planet known as people. And so we just have to be extremely cautious in not moving infected firewood from one area to the other. The Forest Products Laboratory has done some great research on how to properly use heat to be able to make these logs that are moved for firewood not carrying the insect. We know that it's going to take X number of minutes at 160 degrees to be able to kill all of this bark beetle that might be transported. So that's the key. People have to follow best management practices to stop the movement of this insect. And the Department of Natural Resources, the Wisconsin Department of Agricultural Trade and Consumer Protection, along with APHIS, which is part of the U.S. Forest Service, USDA, has been really, as far as I'm concerned, on top of it, and is coming up with some good advertising, marketing programs, because it really does become a psychological thing and a marketing thing as much as anything else. So I'm telling people not to get disheartened. Don't cut down trees. On the other hand, don't plant any more ash trees.
Mm-hmm.
We already knew that we were overstocked with this particular species. I guess we never quite learned the lesson of Dutch elm disease with the concept of monoculture, that if you have too many of one species, then of course the inevitable problem with that species will arise and you'll lose too large a percentage. We're in the middle of a program now in the state called 20 million by 2020. 20 million new trees is the goal in the state of Wisconsin to be planted by the year 2020. And why is that? Well, we know that trees, more than anything else that we can do, will abate the issues of global warming. They take in that carbon dioxide, which we breathe out, which fossil fuels produce. It's the least expensive way to be able to take that carbon dioxide and sequester it back into trees. We also know full well, after many years of research, that planting a variety of trees with upper canopy in an urban area, if we can arrive at that 40% canopy cover area, we will reduce that heat island effect and make our urban environment much more comfortable, reduce the temperature, and absorb much of that heat energy which is dissipated. And more importantly, and this is of great importance, reduce the energy use, because we have to build electric generating facilities to be able to hit peak times of energy use, and that is when we turn on all those air conditioners.
Right.
If we can lower that ambient temperature in an urban area by 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 degrees Fahrenheit, what we have done is reduce that high-capacity load, and therefore we don't have to burn as much fuel, not as much carbon back in the air from all of that coal we're burning, and it would make a much more livable urban area. That's the goal. So trees are very important, and let's hope we can accomplish that 20 million by 2020.
I certainly hope so, and I believe everyone else does as well. And speaking of everyone else, we've got lots of callers online, so all of our lines are filled. So let's go to Rebecca in Black Earth first. Rebecca, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. I have a question about planting white pines. I recently became a member of the Arbor Day Foundation and will be receiving 10 white pine trees closer to the right time to plant them, from what I understand. I would like to use them at the edge of our lot to aid in privacy, so kind of plant them in a row or staggered. And just wondering if there's anything in particular that I need to know about planting white pines or caring for white pines.
You bet, Rebecca. It's a good choice. I love white pines. In fact, my two favorite species, it's white pine for its femininity and just, you know, beautiful, delicate shape. And the bur oak, of course, is sort of on the other end. But the white pine is a beautiful choice. I love Black Earth. It's the first town that I moved to in 1974 when I first came to Wisconsin, lived right on Mill Street. And I remember there were many beautiful white pines there. And remember full well when somebody cut down one that had to be 150 years old. It was this sad, sad moment. Probably inspired me more to go into arboriculture than anything else could have done. Planting is very critical. If you don't put the tree in the ground properly to start out with, it won't have a normal, healthy life. You have to make sure that it's planted at the level in the soil, at the same level in which it came out of the soil as a seedling. So don't overplant. Make your planting hole, rather than a deep bowl, make it a saucer, because we know the majority of roots stay in that upper 12 or 14 inches of soil anyway. So don't overdig the hole. Dig it only as deep as the area of roots that you're going to put in the ground, and that way it won't sink down later. When they build a foundation, they put the footings on undisturbed soil. If they put it on disturbed soil, that building will start to sink down later, and that's the same thing that can happen to a tree. So you want to put it in undisturbed soil, dig it only as deep as the root area, and then use mulch. Mulch will imitate a natural forest soil. We now know that trees are not alone in the soil. There's a rich microflora of fungi that help break down organic matter, reduce the nitrates, and make a much better growing environment for the tree. So using mulch around it is very important. Adequate moisture, and moisture is probably the single most important thing you can do as a nutritional input. Trees are dependent upon moisture. Their whole movement of everything through the vascular system depends upon water, because it's evapotranspiration. It's the loss of water at the leaves that pulls the water up from the roots. There's no heart or pump like we have in mammals that's pushing the water through. So keeping adequate moisture so it functions properly is very important. Placement is important. Even though they're quite small, and it's wonderful the National Arbor Day Foundation does give out free trees to promote the planting of trees, they're small trees coming in, and as you put them in the ground, you'll have a sense, oh, gee, I better put them close together. Think instead 10 years ahead, 15, 20 years ahead. You can get, if you plant properly and have good soil, and there's a reason they call it Black Earth. I remember full well, it's very rich bottom soil, which should grow quite well. And so you want to put them in a placement, and if you're looking for screening particularly, don't put it in a single line, but have two lines staggered. And I would recommend probably, well, let's say initially you put them at, 6 foot separation along those lines. You know, you can always, as they mature if you choose to, you know, thin it out as they do in a plantation setting and reduce it. So as those bigger trees grow together, they'll be further apart. And you'll also find that they're competing with each other, so that some that are more vigorous are going to get bigger anyway. So you can always thin out. So it's better to overplant a little bit initially with that plan, but don't be afraid to take them out later to get better screening. Be well aware that, of course, in maturity, those white pines will lose their lower branches, and so you won't have that lower screening. But at that point, you'll have a magnificent line, double line of beautiful white pines. It'll create all kinds of wonderful wildlife and habitat, and you can always think then, 15, 20 years down the road, of planting something else underneath in the lower canopy. So that's the strategy I would take, Rebecca, on planting those, and it's a
good luck.
Good choice there.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's see, we have another caller from Black Earth, Linda, this time. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Lovely to hear that you were from Black Earth so long ago. And I'm calling about my lilac tree. However, I do want to say that this winter we did take a huge hit in Black Earth on our white pines, especially that major snow we had that was followed by the ice storm later that evening. I know we lost thousands of branches off both of our huge white pines, and if they hadn't each been in a pine stand with other pines, we probably would have lost them. They're very old and very big. However, the suggestion of the double line to the screen, I think, is a very important one, because I think as they do get older, they're not as strong dealing with these big storms. So anyway, I have a really, really old lilac tree. It's huge. It's beautiful. I'd like to know when I think of pruning it, not to prune off the big branches. It's too late for that. It's that old. But the flower buds, you know, when they're done flowering, I have a lot of old, dead flower branches sitting there, and I'm imagining that they're not flowering more because those are sitting there. Can I just cut all of those little flower ends off the whole tree ultimately, and what time of year do I do that?
Okay. Well, and lilacs are such a wonderful contribution to the landscape. I mean, they have such beautiful color. They also provide wonderful screening. And as you say, you know, in maturity, these shrubs really fill in a large area.
Yeah, this is huge. I mean, this is like 30 feet wide,
yeah,
20
and
feet tall.
Probably planted in the 20s or 30s, and, you know, it's been around a long time. And I've seen, you know, those that are even, you know, 100 years old, and real historic or heirloom plants out there. And you'll find that some of the varieties of lilacs from those older times can't be replicated now. So you might even want to think about doing some vegetative cuttings if you have some good ones.
Yeah. Do you do that with the suckers that are on the bottom? Or?
Yeah, you can do that with some of the more juvenile tissue, and you can, you know, again, create, you know, vegetative. I go to get a good book on propagation. There's plenty of them out there. Ortho's got a couple, you know, very easily read books on that topic in the library.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah, it'd be fun to do some of that. Pruning is very important on lilacs because they tend to grow out. They're heliotropic just like any other woody plant. They're looking for sunlight, so they keep on going up. And that's the area in which the floral buds are set. They require a fair amount of sunlight to be able to produce a floral bud. That is one that ends up producing that beautiful flower. And don't be afraid to consider cutting out some of the larger stems, because if they have a well-established root system, you will have additional younger stems coming up from the lower area that will, again, give you that lower-level development of flowers and screening also. Typically, what you'd want to do is take out maybe upwards of a third of some of those stems at any one cutting. And by doing that, you'll have that younger tissue come up. If you have a chance, Linda, if you haven't already done so, go over to the UW Arboretum, which has done a beautiful job, and it's a world-famous lilac collection.
Oh,
Our
really?
Our emeritus professor, Ed Haslicka, still leads a group out there, volunteers to do that annual pruning of the lilacs. The timing of, you might even want to volunteer for that. You're going to learn a tremendous amount of information from that.
Yeah.
And the best time, of course, to prune the lilacs is after the floral buds have been have opened, completed after the flowering. don't be too aggressive, because remember that the floral buds for 2009 are set in 2008. And so what you have now for floral buds will be what is going to be your floral display in the spring. So you don't want to be cutting off too much. But again, if you select out certain older stems, and rather than thinking about pruning on the periphery, think about starting your pruning lower down with some of those older stems. And I think ultimately you'd be happier with that. There's an excellent UW Extension bulletin on pruning lilac trees. Our current and wonderful horticulture professor, extension professor, Dr. Laura Jull, has done just a magnificent job in producing a bulletin on lilacs, which is in full color. I think you, as a lilac person, would really enjoy seeing that also. And again, these are accessible on the internet by visiting the Learning Store, which is part of the UW Extension Service.
Right.
Let me go back a little bit to that white pine, because what you're talking about is pretty important things that that you and others might benefit from. Trees growing in a community of trees, and so you have a large group of white pines that are sheltering each other from windstorms. They produce a wonderful aerodynamic effect. If you have just a few trees, or if you take out a section of trees, suddenly you're creating what are known as edge trees that are more vulnerable to wind. Trees develop resistance to wind and forces, and think of them as being small structures that need to be, you know, held up. I mean, the ambient weight of one of those white pines might be 7 or 8 tons. It's like a small building up there. And so they have to develop, you know, strategies, engineering strategies, to be able to hold themselves up, not against just the ambient weight, that's their own axial weight pushing them down, but also those dynamic forces of wind that blow against the side and bend them over. They do that through a wonderful process called thigomorphogenesis.
Oh, my goodness.
Thigo is Greek for to touch or to perturb. Morphogenesis means to change its shape. And so if I take a great white pine and am pushing on it over time, the living part of that tree on the outside perimeter develops stronger wood as a result of being pushed. Not unlike, I mean, it's different because we're mammals, but if you take an astronaut and put it up in outer space away from the gravitational pressure, their bones start to, you know, have problems. They're not as able to support themselves because, again, there is a reaction of living things to be able to accommodate the environment in which they find them. So if you take down a group of trees and you expose trees that were never exposed before to those wind loads, they're more likely to break. They're called edge trees. So in white pine, with all those limb breaks that you observe, you think that's a terrible thing, but that is a well-evolved defense mechanism for that tree. They've done studies where they've had woody plant physiologists combined with meteorologists follow tornadoes. And tornadoes, of course, are rated F1 through F7, depending upon the velocity of the winds involved. And they follow these storms, noting what velocity winds were there, and then they see what type of trees have failed and how they failed. White pines hardly ever are uprooted. They amend themselves as a result of heavy winds or snow loads by dropping their limbs and become more streamlined and aerodynamic.
Isn't that amazing?
Don't become totally uprooted. It's sort of like a little lizard that's able to, when you grab its tail, let its tail behind, but it survives by doing so. So that's something else you should think about white pines before you put them too close to your house, that they do tend to have that characteristic.
And thank you very much, Linda, for calling. I appreciate your call. Bruce Allison, professional arborist, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mealer. Talking trees on this edition of Garden Talk, Larry Mealer here with my guest, Bruce Allison. And when you phone in, the melodious voice you will hear on the other end of the phone is our producer, Jim Packard, who does a wonderful job every single day. That number to call to talk to Jim and then on to myself and Bruce Allison is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Harriet in Madison is up next, so let's go there. Hi, Harriet.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have five burning bushes, or euonymus, I think is their Latin name. Anyway, they're very full grown, and I would like to thin them out, and I don't know which is the best time of year or how to do it.
Sounds good, Harry. Well, you're lucky to have that burning bush. The euonymus is magnificent, especially if we have the right weather conditions for its full red color to appear in the fall. One that's pretty easy to prune. Again, if you've got a very well-established one that hasn't had a regular pruning, then what you want to do is perhaps do it incrementally. You don't want to just sort of jump into it and cut it all the way back, because you'll find that you don't have many lateral branches in that interior part. Again, trees are very dependent, or shrubs are very dependent. All woody plants are very dependent upon sunlight, and the lateral branches will be formed where you have adequate sunlight to be able to have growth to carry them on and producing the energy. So the interior part tends to be a little bit thinner and doesn't have those lateral branches. And what you're really trying to do is make it more compact. And you can do that by following some of those main stems up from the ground. See where you have multiple branching, that is lateral branches going off on the side, and then selectively cut out those that are reaching out the furthest. You're still leaving that main stem. You're still leaving many lower lateral branches, so you've got, you know, plenty of room for growth. But you're taking those that are what I call erratics, that are growing out further. You cut those back to the main stem, and it's fairly easy with the euonymus. We usually have what we call a 3-to-1 rule. If you're cutting back a branch, you want to make sure that whatever you cut back to is at least 1/3 the diameter of the one you're cutting. So I don't think that'll be a problem with euonymus. Some other species, you really have to watch that pretty carefully. As you bring it back, you'll see that you have remaining lateral branches that are closer in to the main stem, but you've also allowed more sunlight to penetrate in the interior, and so then you start to get some additional adventitious shooting. And adventitious just means that with additional sunlight, cells that were embedded in the bark waiting for the right environmental moment to pop out as a stem suddenly have that opportunity to do so. And so you have the second year more growth in the interior, and then an opportunity in the end of that year to go back and cut more of the peripheral side of those euonymus and bring it down further.
Okay. It sounds complicated.
Does it sound complicated? Well, there's an excellent UW Extension bulletin that, again, you can get either on the web or you can call up. You're in Madison, the Dane County Horticultural Agent, called Pruning Deciduous Shrubs, which will, in a very clear, graphic way, repeat what I have tried to say verbally.
Okay. Well, I like them to be kind of airy, because the birds seem to enjoy being in there, and we have a wren that comes back every year.
Oh, you do? Oh, great. Yeah. Well, and protect those, and again, don't over-prune, but yeah, certainly keep them airy and bring it back, and you might even find that some of those lower stems, especially if they are duplicates, that is, if they're another one right nearby that, you know, does the same thing and holds the same space, you can take out one of those codominants or one of those that is extraneous, so you still open up the center. And that, again, brings more sunlight into the center and keeps it more compact.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Harriet. Peg in Rice Lake, we're on to you. Hi, Peg.
Hi there. I have a question about a tree that probably is hardly ever used in anyone's lawn, the hornbeam or hop hornbeam. I'm not sure. Mine is the one with the rough, light brown trunk, not the light gray, smooth trunk.
Mm-hmm.
Which would that be?
Well, there are two different. There's the hornbeam and the hop hornbeam are two different trees. The hornbeam is the Carpinus genus, and it's a wonderful plant, not as often planted as it should be, but it's a wonderful specimen tree. There are certainly, you know, Rice Lake, you should be able to successfully plant that one.
Oh, I don't plant. I live in the woods.
And live in the woods.
I have both.
So you're exactly. The hop hornbeam is the Austria virginiana, I think, which is also the ironwood. And the ironwood you will certainly find in deciduous or hardwood forest.
But the question is, I got one. I love them. They are over my picnic table, and
they
were just beautiful, and I love the sinews in them, you know?
Yes.
And one, I looked up, and my gosh, all the leaves are gone. There's a few little clusters of leaves here and there, and the rest, it's just bare.
Huh.
And there seems to be one next to it that, as far as I can tell, I think it's the same thing, and it looks okay.
It looks okay, but one has actually defoliated. Do you see any insects feeding on it?
Well, there are always insects out
here. That's right. There's always insects. But do you see that leaves have actually had something munching on them, or is it just...
I haven't noticed it.
Okay, so leaves just simply have dried up and abscised or dropped down on that one. Is there a shade issue, or is there Rice Lake had some drought up there earlier, didn't it?
Yeah, but why would it... Well, what I wonder, do they have any special pest, or do they not live too long? Because this might be quite an old tree.
Okay, well, if we're talking about the hop hornbeam, which is the ironwood tree, they have great longevity. They're a native. They're a companion plant with, you know, the oaks and the hickories and others that would be found in a typical hardwood within Wisconsin. And they are certainly subject to, variety of different types of dieback if you've had a changed environment going on there. Just one thing for clarification, they're called hop hornbeam for a reason, because when they are at that flower stage, you will see that the flowers have the shape of a hop. That is, they have, you know, what appear to be like multiple sepals coming down. They're sort of hanging there. And if you've seen hops, like the hops that are put into beer, that's the shape that they have. And there certainly could be some disease issues that would affect them. What I would do is get some clarification from an expert on there. If you've got two and one is showing some distress, you definitely want to have clarity as to what's going on there. And if you had either a forester, and the foresters would be very conversant with the plant pathology of forest trees up there, they would look at the base of the tree to see if there's any root rot going on. They would see if there's any, indeed, you know, some defoliation that might be coming from insect activities. They would look for any kind of bark beetles. And that's what I would recommend to you if you have that capability. And there's within Rice Lake, I'm sure there the extension of the DNR foresters. And it's hard for me to do a diagnosis just with the data that I have. Mm-hmm. But I think that somebody locally would be very helpful, and particularly if there's a problem that is regional. They would be very well aware of it immediately.
And it's one of those things, if you've got two of those trees close by, one's healthy and one's not, it's possible the healthy one could soon become unhealthy,
well,
too, if something isn't done.
What I'm suggesting, if it's something contagious going on there.
Yeah. So look up a forester in your area, the UW Extension. You can call them, or your DNR forester, and get some advice on who to talk to. And maybe one of them would come out and take a look. Give it a try. Thank you very much, Peg, and good luck to you. And we'll take some more calls. By the way, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. And Frank in Viola is up next. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Frank.
I was noticing about 3 weeks ago that a lot of the bur oaks, in some places 80% or more, are really showing a lot of sign of stress. And we had a lot of rain earlier in the year, and now we just got done with pretty everything dried up pretty good. It was almost a drought, I would call it.
Mm-hmm. Well, take a look at those leaves. There is a anthracnose-like fungus called Tabakia that starts to show up about now, and that can certainly give in the late summer, early autumn, the appearance of great distress and sometimes, you know, close to, you know, a defoliation look. So take a look at those leaves and see if on the leaf you have small little lesions or dots going on there that would suggest a fungal problem. I see Tabakia on bur oak some years more than others, and maybe in Viola you're starting to see some of that early on. So you'd like to identify if that's the problem. If the distress you're seeing is a more generalized dieback, if you have the whole tips dying back, leaves dropping, you know, you could have a couple other problems going on. It doesn't sound to me with that percentage of the bur oaks involved that it's an oak wilt issue. You would tend to see it in more isolated pocket areas. And because bur oaks have a low mortality rate as a result of oak wilt infections, only about 10% or so. And they, you know, certainly could have some root graft, but it tends to be much less a problem than it is in red oaks. So I would doubt that's a problem, although you certainly, you know, want to check that out if these other suggestions I'm giving you don't seem to be a good match. The worst problem that I can think of for bur oaks would be Agrillis bilineatus, which is the two-line chestnut borer. If you have a whole area of distressed oaks, you have this ubiquitous and opportunist insect called the two-line chestnut borer. It's confusing because it's called a chestnut borer. We're talking about oaks. Its main host actually is the oaks. Chestnuts happen to be in the same family as oaks. But it was identified on chestnuts, and that's how it got its name. But if you have a distressed forest, you can have these borers increase in population and start to affect a variety of trees that otherwise might have been marginal but not symptomatic. And it's a beetle that lays its eggs on the bark. The larva, after it hatches from the eggs, drills in through the bark. Healthy trees have a very successful technique called pitching out, where they flood that little larval hole with all the sap and moisture and drown the insect. End of story. If a tree is under especially drought stress, they don't have an adequate amount of moisture. The larva gets through. It feeds underneath the bark, between the bark and that white wood, severing those vascular cells, those xylem cells that are carrying water and nutrients up, and start to stress the tree that way. They then pupate, emerge as an adult beetle, and of course, insect populations increase geometrically, so you all of a sudden you got a lot of these beetles flying around. Check into that. You should be able to see the emergence holes on the bark and on recently dead trees. If you peel back the bark, you'd see both the pupation and feeding galleries just beneath it. But I'm sort of favoring the tabaki idea that maybe it's just a foliar fungal problem in a broad area there. Mm. And I would, I would strongly recommend, you know, looking into that. Viola is such a beautiful area, and they're, as you well know, I mean, that's sort of the heart of the oak forestry area mm-hmm. in the state. Be ashamed to see oaks leaving and a forest lost in that area particularly.
Yeah. Thanks, Frank, for calling. Appreciate your call. Tom and Rhinelander is up next. Let's go to Tom. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Bruce.
Morning.
Yes.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. My question for you today is, you hit on this earlier in your conversation about planting more trees in urban settings to cut down on heat index and other things. And I'm wondering, is it possible to genetically alter some of our favorite trees, our oaks and our maples, so that they could grow like a third to a half taller than they do at this time, and provide even more canopy cover for urban areas?
Well, Tom, that's a great question, and you're obviously putting your thinking cap on trying to think of how we can improve our future using some of, you know, the new technologies. And, of course, you know, ever since we had, you know, Mendel looking at pea plants, we understood that, you know, there is a genetic characteristics that you can promote through vegetative propagation, and clearly that has been done already in selecting red pines that grow more quickly. White pines, you know, in a forest setting, those that tend to have those characteristics of growth, and obviously for forestry purposes. So we have some vegetative propagation selecting them, again, for genetic characteristics. Now we have the capability of altering those genetic characteristics, which, you know, we weren't really able to do before. And, you know, that's what's already happening with, you know, Roundup Ready soybeans and Roundup Ready corn and whatever. We have a lot of genetically modified organisms out there. Certainly there's no reason that we can't use simple vegetative propagation and find oaks that have better growing characteristics or other trees that, you know, that fill in, that are selected for characteristics that favor the urban objectives that we have in mind. I mean, that can be done and should be done, and I think there should be more effort on that. We had, Craig Venter, who was the scientist who, you know, was the first to break the human genome code. We don't have that as broadly for trees yet, although I just read in the New York Times that the government has sponsored a $600,000 effort to be able to map the genomes of select woody plants at the, I think it was the New York Botanical Society is now given that task. So suddenly we'll be able to better understand what the gene location is for certain characteristics, such as better growth or greater density or perhaps more evapotranspiration, whatever it might be, that are going to favor the urban environment in how we can not only alter the hardscape, which we do with faster roads and, you know, better sewer systems and stormwater removal, but start to think in terms of the larger biological world in which we live and how we can alter that to make a better urban environment. So, Tom, the answer is an emphatic yes, it's possible, and it's going to get more possible over time. And I admire you for thinking along those lines.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bruce Allison, our guest today, professional arborist. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Bruce Allison, as we talk trees and shrubs with him today. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. If you have a question, let's go to Jerry in Spring Green next. Jerry, hello.
Hello. I thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a linden tree, which is about 8 or 9 years old. And this spring, the main center branch died. We cut it out. Now another branch is dying. The leaves just fall off. It just goes dead. And I just recently noticed 3 small holes bored into the trunk of the tree. What do you think is happening?
Well, are those holes in a line, either horizontal or vertical? They're horizontal. Okay. Well, more likely than not, that's a sapsucker. You can have bores, as we spoke of before, but those holes would be more randomly scattered, like a shotgun going off, whereas insects, rather birds, have a larger brain and they tend to be much more symmetrical and orderly. And so you will see sapsuckers that will create holes in a line, usually horizontally, but sometimes vertically too. It could be a factor, but I think 3 holes isn't going to be enough to cause the whole decline of that tree. And some people say, well, gee, wouldn't the bird presence indicate that you've got insects underneath that the bird is going for? Maybe to a certain extent, but those sapsuckers are called sapsuckers for a reason. They're actually very cleverly creating holes that have sap come out. That's whole pitching out process that I talked about before. And on that sap, it's like the tar, things stick onto. You have insects that come back and get stuck there, and of course the insect then comes back and they've created a natural trap and they pluck the insects out of that sap. So it's very clever adaptation.
Very tiny holes.
Very tiny holes. Okay,
very tiny.
Tiny means like a 16th
like
of an inch? Or
the lead of a pencil.
Like lead of a pencil. Well, then we might have to go back to the bore problem, because we would tend to get a little bit larger hole if we had that issue of the birds, rather a little bit bigger than a pencil lead. So the ones that died, did you have an opportunity to peel back the bark to see if you saw any feeding galleries underneath of an insect?
No.
Okay.
But It looks like we're going to have to remove this other branch.
Move the whole other branch. Okay. Yeah. Well, there certainly could be, you know, some insects that are causing damage underneath, and these are the emergence of those. And if you've had failure of two major stems, that might also tell you that you really don't have a very vigorous tree, that there's something else going on.
Mm-hmm.
You planted this with a very small plant, or was this like a two-inch caliper plant that came in? Or did you plant it yourself, Jerry?
Yes, we planted it.
Okay.
No, actually, I didn't. We didn't,
you didn't
plant
okay.
that one. We had it planted, and it was probably about 2 inches around.
It was about 2-inch diameter when you put it in the ground. So
it is in a very sandy soil.
In a very droughty, sandy soil, and that can be a big problem there, too. Do you adequately water that, do you think? Do you keep it fairly moist?
Well, we used to, but it's 8 or 9 years old.
8 or 9 years, okay. So you thought it was maybe established enough. Well, even if you had a borer problem, if indeed that was it, but any kind of dieback of that sort would suggest to me that you don't have a vigorous plant. And that could be related to the soil, to the site. Also, take a careful look around the base of that tree and see if you might have something called girdling roots. Sometimes if it's not planted properly and those roots are not pulled out radially at the time of planting, they will tend to grow in a either clockwise or counterclockwise way. And then as the trunk gets a little bit bigger, it will bump up against those girdling roots and impinge those vascular cells, those xylem cells that are carrying water up, and therefore create a lot of stress in the upper part of the crown. So do check that out and also see if there may be at the base of the tree might be some ulcerations in the woody tissue that can sometimes result from a fungus that can get into the base of the tree. But if you're having the main stem has already failed, now you have a secondary stem that's also failed, you might have a much deeper problem. You know, you probably don't have to look any further than at the base of that tree. But do that and see if some of those things that I'm suggesting are indeed possibly there.
And good luck to you. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Karen in Stevens Point will give you an opportunity now. Hi, Karen.
Hi there. We have the infamous oak wilt.
Oh, boy.
And I'm just wondering when the proper months for cutting down the dead trees are.
Okay. The whole idea with the regulation regarding oak wilt, that is in terms of proper pruning removal, is to avoid damage to living trees nearby,
right.
Living oak trees, and not creating a wound, because the ingress of the oak wilt fungus is through a freshly made wound. The time of greatest vulnerability of an infection occurring as a result of that spore or vegetative matter going through the wound is in those spring months when the vascular cells are very wide open. Later on, as the season progresses, those vascular cells get smaller. It's called late wood development. And the movement, the potential movement of a pathogen through those diminishes significantly. So we used to say that from the moment of bud break to full leaf development was the time of vulnerability. We've gotten a little bit more conservative, and a new protocol has just been published a year ago by the DNR plant pathologist Jane Cummings Carlson, which again is available on the web, that says any logging operation should not proceed after April 1st, and it should not occur until after July 15th. A little further north, you can go a little bit earlier for logging operations. She then goes on to say that to be cautious, if you don't need to go back into the woods and take down trees and potentially make additional wounds, then why not wait until close to dormancy? Many municipalities have chosen October 1 as the date to be able to go back and start pruning oaks and causing wounds on those. Stevens Point is sort of one of those mid-range areas where conceivably you could start earlier, but because it has now been put into the regulations for many municipalities, you would do well to check at Stevens Point what indeed their rules might be. And I'm guessing with one of the most important urban forestry schools in the United States at Stevens Point that they might have been persuaded to go as late as October 1. But long-winded answer, your problem of infection diminishes very rapidly after you have full leaf development. You still have some potential, perhaps, although it's not been very clearly shown in natural area studies. Artificially, you can infect, but in terms of actual studies, and a recent study done, I think, in your area or nearby, where utility companies participated in large areas, it was discovered that there would be very little oak wilt infection that occurred late in the growing season. But if you don't need to take it down before October 1st, you know,
hang on.
Well, yeah, hang on and take them down then, so there's absolutely zero potential and you're outside of any controversial dates.
All right. Thank you very much for your calling, and I'm sorry for your oak trees. That's too bad. Kathleen and Fifield is up next. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you doing today?
Good.
I did answer one question. I know when to prune my young white oak. I'm presuming October thereon would be the best.
Yes.
It's around 8 to 10 years old. All the branches are still there as after it has been, you know, as it's been growing. Nothing has been cut at this point. And I'm being told I should be pruning the lower branches of the oak.
And what is the rationale for pruning? What have they told you?
Something about the upper growth strength. I guess that was pretty much what they were saying. Now, this was just a neighbor. It's
okay.
Not like someone who's an expert, maybe. I don't know.
And like so many other things, Kathleen, our knowledge base evolves over time. And some people thought, well, if we strip up the lower branches and just have, you know, some upper crown branches, maybe they'll have more energy to grow, forgetting that the energy comes from the leaves themselves, that the leaves are through photosynthesis producing carbohydrates, and that's the source of energy. There is a theory in arboriculture called the autonomous limb theory, which says that each limb has to produce enough food for itself to grow, and then it has to contribute to that part of the tree, maybe 10% or so of its energy going to that part of the tree that is not able to produce its own food, that is the bark, the woody tissue that's in the inside, the root system, and whatever. Lower branches, if they get shaded out over time, will not be able to produce their own food and then die. That is, they can't take the carbohydrates from the upper crown to be able to keep them going. There's no, if you will, socialism within the world of plants. It's a mean capitalistic world. If you can't make it on your own, you can't borrow from somebody else. So that's good because you wouldn't want tree limbs in the lower shaded area that are not being very productive, borrowing from the part that is productive. So that would limit the growth up where you really want the growth. So there's no need to worry about those lower branches being there forever. Eventually, as the tree gets bigger, they'll take care of themselves by shading out those lower branches. We also know now that with wind blowing up against a tree, if we just strip up the lower branches and just have branches on the top only, we don't necessarily let the wind pass through. Instead, we create a pendulum. That is, those upper branches are moving back and forth much faster and putting more sway and oscillation into the trunk than we would have had otherwise. And those lower branches tend to have a dampening effect on that movement of the tree, which is to the tree's advantage. So I would say that unless there is a clearance issue that, you know, you're bumping into these lower branches and poking eyes out or cars need to pass by there.
Not at all. It's in a pasture.
It's in a pasture. Then I would definitely encourage you to
just leave them until it obviously down the road it looks like they need to be taken off.
Yeah, or just let them die by themselves. Let them take a normative shape.
Oh, because so grateful.
There's
it is so beautiful, and I just don't want to touch it.
But, yeah, there's wisdom in how these trees have evolved. So I would just let it go as is.
Oh, thank you so much for that.
All right,
bye, Kathleen.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Karen in Whitewater, it's your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have an ornamental pagoda dogwood in my front yard. It's got about 7 or 8 tiers. I'm going to say it's maybe 15 to 20 feet tall. And every year over the past 3 or 4 years, we are having some large branches that are dying and either not leafing out at all or not leafing out, but also turning almost a bright yellow.
Uh-huh.
And we're not sure if that's a natural thing or if there's something going on with the tree. And we historically have pruned those branches out. This year we chose not to see what sort of happened, and we don't know what is best.
Okay. Well, the pagoda dogwood tends to get this branches will get a canker in its guts, a golden canker. Those reddish-colored twigs will suddenly turn, and I don't know whether this is the yellow that you're referring to or whether it's just the leaves that turn yellow, but the twig itself will turn golden and eventually kind of brown, and that's because of a fungus that tends to move into that very soft, moist tissue. So it's a characteristic of the pagoda dogwood, certainly exacerbated by the fact that the pagoda dogwood's a little bit out of its climate range. And if you have a winter, particularly if it's on the south side of the house, that might get a little extra heat load, and it starts to lose some of its winter dormancy, and all of a sudden that night it drops really cold again. So take a look at that golden canker and see if that's an issue, and prune those off and keep it well watered in the spring.
Bruce Allison, our guest professional arborist here on Garden Talk. We're talking trees and shrubs on this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest professional arborist, Bruce Allison. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. And Bruce, every one of our lines is filled, so let's go to the phones. Amy in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi, I'm really glad you put this on because I have junipers and arborvitaes that were planted late last November, and you know the winter we had.
Yes.
So there's a lot of brown spots, and I'm wondering how to save them, improve their look, and keep them better this winter.
So you planted those junipers and arborvitae just last spring. That is a year ago spring.
The landscaper planted them in November just before Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Just before the snow.
Oh, just before the snow. Okay, so and
yeah, within a week we had the first big snowfall.
Yeah, and that's probably part of the problem. The UW Extension Bulletin recommends that evergreens not be planted, you know, after that October period, and the reason for that is that it takes a while for those roots to get established to be able to bring up enough moisture to be able to overwinter successfully. So, you know, it's not to say that it couldn't have in a better environment to survive, but if you add some additional stresses, you don't have the preparation, you don't have that root system established. Roots will continue to grow for a period of time after the shoots stop growing, and that's where they kind of get a chance to get some establishment before you start, you know, having moisture stress. And of course, conifers don't have the advantage that these angiosperms that are deciduous, that is, they drop their leaves, because the leaves, of course, are where moisture's lost. If you drop that particular organ, then you don't have to worry about the moisture leaving, whereas the conifers are holding on, and they continue to have some moisture loss during the winter months. And so if you don't have a good root system, there's no chance to replace. Even in the early fall, you will tend to get that desiccation or drying back, which usually doesn't become symptomatic or obvious until the spring. It's just that they're dead during the winter, but they stay green, and then suddenly the spring comes and they all turn brown. And that's sometimes called, you know, frost damage. So what do you do at this particular point? If you've lost a large percentage of those new ones, then you go back to your one-year guarantee and say, well, gee, could you, you know, replace these and maybe consider replacing them next spring rather than doing a fall planting. If you have a sufficient amount to keep the trees alive and they've established a bit of a root system now, then simply carefully cut out all of the dead tissue that you see and cut it back to the live tissue. Do not cut any green tissue because you really need every last cubic inch of that you have to be able to have survivability. And then this fall, before the ground freeze, soak up that soil heavily, almost to full field capacity, to, you know, to the point that it's actually puddling. And the reason you're doing that is that a couple reasons. When they continue to grow, you'll know you'll have some moisture. You'll actually have moisture in the spring in case we have a snowless winter. But more importantly, what you're doing is protecting the roots by reducing the depth of the frost. Our great-great-grandparents knew full well that when you took a tub of water and put it in the root cellar, that there was a tremendous amount of heat energy in that water that, as it cooled, was released into the air and therefore kept that root cellar above freezing. It's the lake effect, if you will, and you can use that same concept by putting a lot of moisture in the root system, and therefore the depth of the frost won't go as low, which means that the attrition of those fine root hairs that otherwise, if the frost got there, they would die, you wouldn't have as many available in the spring, doesn't occur, and you'll have a more viable plant in the spring to continue growing.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Amy. Patty and Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Patty.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually was calling because we had an elm tree in our backyard that we just recently took down because apparently some type of bug got underneath the bark and had been slowly but surely destroying it. And the bug really looks like a cross between a centipede and a millipede. And it left images of itself in the wood. It looks like it was anywhere from an inch, and some of them were up to maybe 2.5, almost 3 inches long. Lots of little legs, and basically, I see holes on the inside of the bark where they maybe have gone in and out, but the bottom line is that it finally, you know, really destroyed the tree, which was sad because it was over 100 years old.
Hmm.
What I'm actually, I'd like to know what that is, but I'd also like to know if you could tell me if we know what that is, it will affect the black walnut that grew up next to it. And then on the other side of the yard, we have about 150-year-old pin oak.
A pin oak also. Well, I'm a little confused by that insect causing the demise of that tree. Typically, elms will succumb to Dutch elm disease. You can also have the elm bark beetle, which will leave a squiggly appearance and actually quite beautiful from an artistic standpoint.
Yeah, this actually is rather beautiful, but
okay.
the insects themselves, unless that's the way they operate, it looks like they were long-bodied and had lots of legs.
Might have been some other secondary insects.
I'm thinking that's the case. You know what an earwig looks like, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. I mean,
they're not earwigs. And you might have had, you know, some, indeed, you know, a variant of the centipede or, you know, a millipede that might have got in there underneath the bark and just sort of using that as brood wood as opposed to having caused the primary problem.
Elm bark beetle would have been more likely to.
The elm bark beetle would have left you those feeding or pupation galleries that, again, are, you know, multi-winged.
Squiggly.
It's squiggly. It's like a fan or, you know, almost a leaf, you know, vein pattern coming out. But again, I doubt that that would have been the demise of the tree. It's the elm bark beetle, of course, is the insect vector of Dutch elm disease, which is a fungus.
Oh.
So I'm thinking, I don't know who advised you on the causality of
death. No, well, they didn't really say it killed it. We just were making that assumption when we had one of the logs and all the bark fell off of it.
Oh, that's right.
And we saw on the, actual wood itself these long squiggly lines, but then all of these images of what looked like an insect with, you know, like millipede kind of legs.
Exactly. Well, I'm guessing that those indeed are secondaries, that those are, you know, in there to the wood. And if you have, again, you know, a millipede, a very distinctive, you know, then a typical insect that has six legs, the millipedes, centipedes will have, you know, multiple legs.
Oh, yeah. This looks more like a millipede even than a centipede. And so the fact that they were secondary, then we shouldn't worry about impact on the black walnut
Correct.
Next to it or the pin oak.
Or the pin oaks, exactly. They would be just fine. I mean, you know, just do be aware with the pin oak of, you know, being careful not to introduce oak wilt into that, which is very closely related to Dutch elm disease in the sense that it's a vascular wilt. The difference between the oaks and the elms is that the elm with the elm bark beetle could create the wound, so you didn't need to have pre-existing wounds. Mm-hmm. With the oaks, it has to have a wound either from wind in the spring or somebody pruning at the wrong time of year. to allow the pathogen to have access to the vascular system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been pretty careful about allowing any trimming at, you know, the wrong time of the year or anything like
Good.
That. And we've been kind of watching for the gypsy moth caterpillars, but we've seen none.
Oh, good.
Good for
That's
you.
That's great.
We thank you very much for calling, by the way. Appreciate your call. And one of the parks near where I live, at Olbrich Park there, the gypsy moths were much in evidence.
I put up multiple traps. I would probably put up 250 or so traps a year. And this year, I've been doing it for 10 years. This year, the number of male moths are very significant. I mean, some traps we normally would get 12, 15, you know, or so. We're getting 75, 80 in an individual little delta-shaped trap. So the moths were flying around. And, of course, those are the male moths you get in the pheromone traps. The females don't move very far, but... Yeah. What happened this year, of course, is we didn't really have as much defoliation in Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin, as we did last year. And that was, as you might have observed, with all that rain we had in June, like, what, 16 inches or whatever. How could you miss that? We had an environment more conducive to development of some of the parasites, the entomophaga, which is a fungus that gets into the insect and reduces their feeding significantly. Plus, I think a very successful DNR-sponsored spray program, an airplane spray program with Bacillus thuringiensis caristaki that made a difference, at least in that area that I look at, you know, within southern Wisconsin.
And I misspoke. I said Olbrich. I meant Olin Park.
Olin Park. You got a lot of beautiful trees that are 200-plus years old there. You want to protect those.
You sure do. Lori in Neshkoro, it's your turn now. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I guess two questions real quick. Black walnut trees, I just was thinking of those while your other caller had called in. Could the black walnut tree have killed the elm tree next to it?
No. The the black walnut, of course, has that characteristic of allelopathy. That is, it controls the vegetative growth around it by producing a growth regulator called juglones through its roots, and it drips down from other parts of the tree too. But it's not going to be successful in inhibiting significantly an elm, and particularly, you know, the elm is probably well established, you know, to have, you know, gotten that size. So good, you know, good point that has a very interesting characteristic of the black walnut, but that would not have been the demise and wouldn't even have significantly diminished the health of a nearby elm to make it more vulnerable to secondaries.
And before you were discussing how the, you know, not to take off the bottom limbs of a tree to encourage top growth more.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, you know, I put the black walnut, you know how the lower limbs just grow down towards the ground?
Yes.
And it creates more shade, you know, than I would prefer.
Yes.
If removing those limbs, will that affect a black walnut tree adversely? I mean, it seems like they're so brittle. Whenever there's a storm, they're the first ones to go. And even just to give it a good yank, and they'll just come right off
sure.
to where they attach to the tree.
So we are talking black walnut, not black locust, right?
No, we're talking black walnut.
Okay.
Real quick.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, the black walnut, if you certainly want to, you know, leave those lower branches, but if you want to take some off,
go ahead.
You know, moderately, there's no reason not to. If you want to get some additional sunlight in that lower area, that makes perfect sense. And again, part of it, I mean, I sort of spoke about the engineering aspects of trees and their ability to tolerate the wind and the force of the dynamic forces. And so stripping up too much of those lower branches will indeed create the pendulum effect. But taking off some of those lower branches doesn't have much of a physiological effect for that same reason of the autonomous limb theory that I was speaking of. I mean, those lower limbs will tend to be less vigorous because they don't get as much sunlight there anyway. So it seems reasonable to take those off to give yourself some benefit. My theory on pruning, again, you know, assuming that you know, trees have taken millennia to establish, you know, the shape and to have characteristics that are to their own benefit of that particular species. you don't want to alter that necessarily unless you see some overriding reason. So you'd like to have a reason to do pruning and then weigh that reason against whatever advantage those limbs or that part of the tree might be providing to the species. And so, but taking off a few lower branches isn't going to hurt the tree physiologically significantly at all and would give you some advantage if indeed you want more sunlight lower down.
Okay. Now, black locust had an area in the forest clear cut a while ago where there was locust. And so, of course, now there's just it's just a maze of black locusts, small black locust trees, and box elder. Now, we had done some killing of the larger black locust trees with a chemical I can't remember, but it was very expensive because you had to mix it with bark oil, and the bark oil comes in such quantities and is so terribly expensive. So someone suggested that I try Tardon or Tordon.
Yeah.
And just, you know, nick the trees. I thought I would just go out there with my clippers and give them a good clip and then get the Tardon in them. Is that realistic or am I just wasting my time?
Well, Tordon is a very strong herbicide and can have some lateral translocation in the soil. So you've got to be pretty doggone careful using that. And it's one that I just don't feel all that comfortable having people that don't use it on a regular basis. It certainly can be used, you know, for utility clearance where they've got a large area of trees to knock down. But because it has the potential to move in the soil so much, you've got to be a little cautious on that one. There might be other strategies you can use if you've got to knock down a large number of woody plants. We at the Arboretum, UW Arboretum, have developed some strategies for ecological restoration, which means taking out some of the invasives and allowing a more native collection of woody plants to grow in their place. Their strategy is also as appropriate to use herbicides, but they're going to use some of the more readily, you know, generally available general purpose herbicides such as glyphosate, which is Roundup. And again, any pesticide that you use, you know, you want to make sure you know what you're doing, have the potential maybe to even, you know, have a professional who's a licensed pesticide applicator apply it. But if you choose to do it yourself, you know, cutting that stem flush and then applying on the stem, directly on the stem, so it doesn't get anywhere else. And typically what we would do is to put in some green dye, the same kind of dye that they spray onto Christmas trees before they sell them to you. To give it a, well, not all Christmas trees, but in some cases a greener color, so that you know which ones, if you got a large number of stems, you want to know which ones you've hit and which ones you didn't.
Right.
And again, following carefully, you know, label instructions, you know, with appropriate protection for yourself. That's one possibility. Black locust, of course, and box elders, these are pioneer species. They come in after you've opened up and disturbed an area. And black locusts particularly are legumes, just like peas are, soybeans are. They can fix their own nitrogen. So they're, you know, from a stance of trying to restore a forest, I mean, it's very appropriate for that particular plant to come in there to reestablish the soil, and then, you know, ultimately over, you know, X number of years, you would have other species coming in their place. But particularly if you have a plan for planting different species, taking out those that are somewhat more evasive now and accelerating that process is, you know, an appropriate thing to do for sure.
Sure. All right.
Would Roundup be effective, though, on black locust?
Yeah, it should be if it's applied as a stem application during warm weather. So if you've just freshly cut those and you apply, you know, the glyphosate, which is the Roundup, one of the, you know, the brand names is Roundup.
I think it has to be above 50 degrees.
Exactly. It has to be
above,
warmer.
Okay. Yeah.
And then people sometimes in the, you know, the colder weather, they use an oil-based one called Garlon. But again, I think you would do well to get some good literature on that, you know, stem applications of herbicides, and there's plenty of it available, good stuff through the UW Extension and some of the other university extensions accessible on the internet.
Good luck.
Okay, and just one more quick question. The black locust spread only through the root system?
No, they also can. They have that very successful you know, vegetative growth through the root system. They have, you know, the runners that go out and they pop up, you know, through their roots. And that's why they tend to be in clusters like that. But also they produce seeds, so they can sexually reproduce also.
All right. Mm. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Very helpful.
All right. Thanks for calling. Bob and Claybanks, your turn.
Hi. Thanks for having the show.
Sure.
Two quick questions, I hope. First, Bruce, how long and how often should you deep water trees?
Okay, well, it's a great question because deep water is not what I recommend.
Oh.
Unless you mean by deep watering just an excessive amount of water on there. We typically in Wisconsin get about 40 inches of moisture per year, which, you know, during the growing season kind of comes out to about 4 inches per month. So you'd like to at least replicate that by your watering. Now, if you've had 16 inches in June, you have to sort of adjust that and not just take the average, but say if we don't have any rain, you know, for a month after that and we start to have lawn that's turning brown or whatever, then you know that you also have some water stress. And you can actually, as you know, a forester or a gardener, you're used to sticking your hand, you know, in the soil, and you can very quickly tell whether you have an adequate amount of moisture for good growth just by the sense of the feel of it. So trying to think in terms of 4 inches per month or an inch per week is the way to start. And by if you mean by deep watering, putting a sprinkler on and just have a lot of water, that's eventually going to go down. But this concept of these root feeders or pipes going down 2 or 3 feet into the ground and then putting the water down there is not a good idea. That might not be what you meant by that. But putting,
that is what I meant.
That is what you meant.
No.
Oh, that's not what you meant.
No, it is what
What is what you meant. Okay. We know from studies that are done at the Morton Arboretum empirical studies, the Morton Arboretum in Lyle, Illinois, comparable soils here, that 90% of the root surface area is in the first 12 inches of soil. You know, yes, there's some root volume lower, some of those bigger sinker roots. But the root surface area, and roots are involved in uptake of water and nutrients, so it's the surface area, which is the important aspect of it, the important statistic to take a look at, is the first 12 inches of soil, which, if you think about it, makes perfect sense. That's where the oxygen, that's where the nutrients are for mineral recycling, and that's where the majority of water is going to come from rainfall. So,
yeah, we're kind of short on time, so I wanted to get my question in on
okay.
The road.
Good.
If I could. I've got a red oak that I planted about 5 or 6 years ago that's been growing slowly. And last couple of years, it's gotten brown leaves with still the green veins in there. And I've watered it, and it seems to have kind of come back a little bit. But I wonder if that's oak wilt and if I'm actually breeding a carrier here.
If it's oak wilt, that tree would be dead within 2 weeks. Red oak has 100% mortality rate, so you're probably not dealing with oak wilt. Could be anthracnose, which is a foliar fungus. Take a look at that. They have lesions that occur on the surface of the leaf as that spore lands on the leaf. If there's adequate amount of moisture, usually in the spring, little tendrils will come out of that spore after, you know, 24 or 48 hours in the moisture, and they'll break through the epidermal cells, those skin cells, and get into those rich green palisade cells underneath and then cause that to turn brown. And if there's enough of those lesions, the whole area looks brown. And the other thing you might want to consider, especially with those green veins sticking out, you might have a lime-induced iron chlorosis, depending upon your soil type. If you have severe chlorosis, which means lack of nitrogen, consequently, because nitrogen, not nitrogen, lack of iron, you'll have inhibited development of the chlorophyll, which is the green part, and the leaf will start looking kind of yellow, and if it's bad enough, it'll actually be browned out, but the green veins will stand out. So take a look at that. Maybe do a soil pH test. If it's about 6.5, 6.3, 6.8, that's fine. If it gets above 7, and there's alkalinity, you can sometimes get that yellowing on the red oaks.
Mm. And thank you very much for calling. And Bruce, thank you so much. Time flew by.
It did, Larry. Wonderful to be with you and your listeners.
We'll be looking forward to your next visit.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Bruce Allison, professional arborist, our guest here on the Ideas Network. We'll have him back in about a month or so, and we'll talk with him again about those trees and shrubs. Just to let you know, on Monday's program, we've got Bill Boyson Alton, Laurie Tyne Brody. Bill, an associate professor. Laurie Tyne Brody is a physical therapist with the UW Sports Medicine Center, and they will be along to talk with us about physical therapy to restore your health. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.